Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. We're going to continue what we did last week, and that is we're going to begin with a series of articles on the implications of our current dispute with Iran. Now, these are not political in nature. They are simply talking about the economic implications of this conflict. The first article is from Fortune and the Associated Press, dated April 14th. Title of the article is IMF slashes global growth forecast, blaming war in the Middle East for halted momentum. The Iran war has stalled the world's economic momentum this year, likely pushing growth lower compared to 2025, the International Monetary Fund warned Tuesday. The IMF downgraded its forecast for global growth to 3.1% in 2026. From the 3.3% it had forecast back in January. The expected growth would mark a deceleration from a 3.4% expansion in 2025. U.S. and Israeli strikes on Iran and Tehran's closing of the Strait of Hormuz and retaliatory strikes on oil refineries and other energy infrastructure in neighboring countries have driven oil and gas prices sharply higher around the world. As a result, the IMF marked up its expectations for global inflation this year to 4.4% from 4.1% in 2025 and from the 3.8% it had forecast for this year in January. Until the war, the world economy had shown surprising resilience in the face of President Donald Trump's protectionist policies, which built a wall of import taxes around the United States, the world's biggest economy, and once a market practically open to imports. The damage was less than feared, partly because Trump's tariffs last year have ended up being lower than what he'd originally announced. A tech boom marked by massive investment in data centers and artificial intelligence, and rising productivity also combined to strengthen the world economy. War in the Middle East has halted this momentum, IMF chief economist Pierre-Olivier Gourinchas wrote in a blog post accompanying the fund's latest world economic outlook. The IMF's forecast assumes the conflict in the Persian Gulf is short-lived, and that energy prices would rise a moderate 19% this year. Things could be much worse in a severe scenario in which the energy shocks spill into next year and central banks are forced to raise interest rates to combat inflation. Global growth could drop to 2% in 2026 and 2027. Despite the recent news of a temporary ceasefire, some damage is already done, and the downside risks remain elevated, Gourinchas wrote. The fund slightly downgraded its forecast for U.S. growth this year to 2.3%. The 21 European countries that share the euro currency, hard hit by soaring natural gas prices, will collectively grow 1.1% this year, down from 1.4% in 2025, the IMF forecast. Hardest hit are likely to be deeply indebted poorer countries that import energy and can't afford to buffer their economies with stepped-up government spending and tax relief. The IMF sharply lowered the outlook for sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, to 4.3 from this year, from the 4.6 it had expected in January. One winner that's emerging from the conflict is Russia, an energy exporter that stands to benefit from higher prices. The IMF upgraded its forecast for the Russian economy, hard hit by sanctions following the invasion of Ukraine in 2022, to a still modest 1.1%. Meanwhile, the governor of the National Bank of Ukraine has tried to keep Russia's war in his country at the center of talks among global economic leaders. But in a Monday interview with reporters, Andrei Pieshne noted how higher oil prices due to the war in Iran are hurting his country. He said through a translator that annual inflation in March hit 7.9% in Ukraine, well above the forecast of 7%, in a large part because of higher fuel costs. He estimated that fuel prices could push up annual inflation by 1.5% to 2.8 percentage points. Pushney noted that there could also be higher fertilizer and production costs in an economy that's seeking stable prices as part of the ongoing war with Russia, which attacks Ukraine by air on an average of every 3 to 4 minutes. "We're trying to walk on a razor blade," he said, "of a mission complicated by external factors." The IMF is a 191-nation lending organization that works to promote economic growth and financial stability and to reduce global poverty. Our second article is also from Fortune magazine by Jason Ma, dated the 13th of April. Again, same topic. U.S. naval blockade on Iran will trigger a currency devaluation spiral and hyperinflation, potentially ending the war more quickly, analysts said. The U.S. blockade on ships entering or departing from Iranian ports went into effect on Monday as President Donald Trump seeks to pressure Iran by cutting off its oil revenue. The Iranian economy was already in a shambles before the U.S. and Israel launched their war on the Islamic Republic more than 6 weeks ago, and reports indicate the relentless bombing has pushed the regime to the brink. Despite heavy losses Iran's military has suffered, it still has enough missiles and drones to effectively close off the Strait of Hormuz while allowing its own oil tankers to get through. Tehran's control of the narrow waterway is its most potent weapon as global energy markets reel from shortages, but a U.S. blockade could turn the table. Leaning on this money machine sends the economy into a tailspin, giving the mullahs much-needed motivation to negotiate in earnest. Robin Brooks, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, wrote in a Substack post on Monday, "That's after U.S.-Iran talks in Pakistan broke down over the weekend, putting a fragile 2-week ceasefire in doubt, as both sides appeared unwilling to budge. Meanwhile, the market's reaction to the blockade has been muted, with the S&P 500 and NASDAQ largely flat, while oil prices have pared gains." Brooks acknowledged the regime may not be bothered by the economic hardship the Iranian people suffer due to the blockade, adding it's uncertain how many weeks it must be in effect to spur Tehran on talks. "But what I do know is this, as Iran's oil exports collapse, there'll be no cash for imports, so activity implodes, the currency goes into a devaluation spiral, and hyperinflation ensues," he predicted. "In fact, hyperinflation may be imminent." Residents of Tehran, and other cities told Reuters some prices have shot up around 40% since the war began, as the rial has plunged 8% against the dollar on the black market. The economic consequences of a blockade are so dire that Brooks declared, "There's no doubt in my mind the regime will re-engage in talks. To be sure, stopping the flow of Iranian oil could cause further disruption in energy markets. But," he pointed out, "Iran is a relatively small supplier of oil, and cutting it off shouldn't lift Brent crude futures much above $120 a barrel. On Monday, the benchmark price was up 6% to $100.88 after surging 8% earlier. Overall, the blockade has more pros than cons, and its effect on oil is a manageable risk," he added. "The goal is to end this war more quickly by bringing the mullahs to the negotiating table in good faith." Brooks has been calling for a naval blockade since Iran closed off the Strait of Hormuz. Others have also touted it as a preferred option over deploying U.S. ground troops to seize control of the strait. The blockade also stops well short of Trump's prior apocalyptic threats to bomb Iran back to the Stone Age and to wipe out its civilization. Mayed Maliki, a senior advisor at the Foundation of Defense for Democracies and a former Treasury Department official, calculated the U.S. naval blockade will cost Iran about $435 million a day in economic damage, or $13 billion per month. The rial enters terminal collapse. Iran's alternatives outside the strait can replace less than 10% of the Gulf throughput. The blockade makes continued resistance economically impossible, he posted on X. Next is our last article of the day on this particular topic, again from Fortune magazine, this time by Eleanor Pringle, dated April 13th. The title of the article is, Investors are writing off any move from the Fed this month. Collapsing talks in Iran have sealed the deal. With President Trump's focus squarely on Iran at present, Jerome Powell and the U.S. Federal Reserve are getting some respite from the Oval Office's attention. It's a couple of weeks until the next Federal Open Market Committee, FOMC, meeting, but investors already appear to be convinced what the group's next move will be. The base interest rate is, at present, between 3.5 and 3.75%, and investors are pricing more than 97% chance that it will stay there the next meeting on April 28th, per CME's FedWatch monitor. Furthermore, it seems that the rate cuts the likes of President Trump and Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent have been requesting are out of the picture entirely at the next meeting as far as traders are concerned. The remaining 2.6% are pricing in a hike of 25 basis points. The odds of a Fed hold firmed up in traders' minds following Friday's inflation data, which showed prices rose 3.3% over the last 12 months, with gas prices playing a major part of the increase. The rise stems from the Iran conflict. Oil prices have increased because Iran borders the Strait of Hormuz, a narrow waterway in the Persian Gulf through which exports from the UAE, Qatar, Kuwait, and Iraq all flow. Some 20 million barrels of oil typically flow through the strait every day, about 20% of global supply. Iran has made it clear that it controls the strait, and it said it has littered the area with mines. Ship captains are too nervous to enter the waterway, choking off supply and sending prices spiraling. Over the weekend, hopes that the relations between Iran and the U.S. might improve were dashed. Vice President J.D. Vance said following peace talks, Iran had chosen not to accept the offered terms. Halting Iran from securing a nuclear weapon is reportedly a sticking point in the negotiations. The expectation of a permanent deal being reached sooner than later fell sharply on Polymarket last night. Most traders still in the bet are of the opinion that a deal will be reached by June 30th, though odds of an agreement at any point are falling across the board. With no concrete end in sight for when oil supply might normalize, traders are setting into the idea that the Fed will be unlikely to move. After all, inflation is now moving in the opposite direction to the Fed's mandated 2% target. For the Fed to cut, adding more liquidity to the economy while prices are already elevated would be highly unusual, but might be justified if another element of the Fed's mandate demanded it. Maintaining employment is another role of the Fed, and there's been some good news. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics reported earlier this month the non-farm payroll employment increased in March, up 178,000. And the employment rate held steady at 4.3%. This is another boon to the argument for a hold, as the labor market is showing potential for strengthening without any intervention on the base rate. Despite that, sentiment and volatility is shifting fast at the moment, a hallmark of the second Trump administration. For all the conviction for a hold today, those bets could unwind tomorrow, based on a nod from the White House or a speech from a central banker. Some might argue that this Fed watching actually undermines the job of the central bank, the third part of its mandate being moderate long-term interest rates in order to ensure stability of expectations for monetary policy. Rapidly cycling through outcomes, it sits at odds with the role of the Fed. According to famed economist and former PIMCO CEO Mohammed El Arian in December, it's crazy. This should not happen. The whole point of forward guidance is predictability and stability, so there's something wrong that has to be addressed. The rest of the world looks at this and says, wait a minute, is the Fed at the core of the system? And there's so much volatility in what they expect they're going to do in a few weeks. What's going on here? UBS's Paul Donovan also pointed out this morning that despite speeches from central bankers across the world this week, it's still too early to glean true insight into the outcomes of interest rate setting meetings. He told clients there are assorted central bank speakers this week who've no insight into the course of the war. It is too soon to identify potential second-round effects in inflation or labor markets. We're going to talk tariffs in our next article. It's by Sasha Rogelberg from Fortune magazine, dated April 15th. Title of the article is, People Are Trying to Be Creative. Tariff-battered American companies are so cash-starved that they're using refund claims as collateral for loans. When the Supreme Court struck down President Donald Trump's tariffs 2 months ago, many companies rejoiced at the prospect of returning to pre-tariff prices and the possibility of getting a refund back from the government. However, the ruling may have also created a $166 billion problem. U.S. importers, who've shouldered the brunt of the tariffs, are now waiting to receive an estimated $166 billion in refunds on the levies. But, battered by supply chain woes as a result of the import tax, hiked energy prices thanks to the Iran war, and nervous consumers bracing for a recession, many large companies are scrambling for cash. Businesses are struggling, said Alex Hennick, president and CEO of A.D. Hennick & Associates, a liquidation firm that specializes in distressed asset recovery. The economy is tough right now. The cost of manufacturing is up, traffic is down, and retail sales are down. So this can be a situation where the company is struggling and they need this money in order to survive. He told Fortune, it's a situation where people are trying to be creative. And the data backs him up. A KPMG survey in February found more than half of U.S. companies experienced compressed margins, with 82% reporting a decline in foreign sales, while 61% reporting a decline in domestic ones. Nearly 70% of firms said they delayed major investments as a result of the tariffs. In February, the Supreme Court deemed tariffs imposed under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, the IEEPA, unlawful, and laid the groundwork for the U.S. companies to recoup what they paid over the year the tariffs were in place. However, there are still question marks on when these refunds will be distributed and how much of them businesses will actually see. The highest court offers no specifics on how the refunds would be determined or distributed, leaving it up to the Court of International Trade and U.S. Customs and Border Protection to determine the refund process. According to the CBP, once an automated payment system is online, refunds should take 45 days to distribute. The first phase of the system's deployment will launch on April 20th. Some companies can't afford to wait. Instead, cash-hungry businesses are taking their tariff refunds claims to the bank and using them as collateral for loans. It's something where you're better off having it now and trying to make it than waiting. According to a recent CBP filing at the end of March, of the more than 330,000 U.S. importers affected by tariffs, 26,664 have signed up for the agency's automatic refund system, or just 8% of all importers. Those importers already account for $120 billion in tariff revenue, according to the documents, meaning any importers who sign up for a refund will only be able to request reimbursement from what remains of the $166 billion in tariff revenue. Many of the large companies hit hardest by tariffs, particularly those in the manufacturing and automotive industries, retail, and consumer goods, could see using refund claims as loan collateral as worth it, Hennick suggested. Despite interest rates on loans remaining elevated for the past 5 years, the prospect of immediately receiving cash is a relief to companies who are still grappling with the uncertainty on when exactly they'll get their refunds. It's also an alternative to the $100 billion secondary market that has emerged around companies selling the rights to refund claims to hedge funds and liquidity specialists. Selling the rights to tariff refund claims may allow companies to outright receive a fraction of the eventual refund value and relinquish the headache of refund uncertainty, but it also means they're unable to cash in on the greater refund they would have received had they chosen to wait out the rebate process. Webb Harrell, a broker and head of a trading group at capital markets firm Seaport Global, told Fortune that in these instances, the loan-to-value ratio of potential refunds used as collateral might be about 50%, meaning a 10% $10 million refund claim would be worth only $5 million as a loan. By comparison, companies selling the rights to their refund claims are doing so for about a quarter of their projected value. According to Hennick, whatever decision companies make on how to leverage the refund claims comes down to their appetite for risk. But he predicts more firms than not will have to make tough choices as opposed to simply waiting for refunds. It's coming to the point where some people might have no choice, he said. They're either going to have to sell their claims or they're going to have to borrow money to get money in order to continue operating their businesses. Harrell, however, sees meaningful risks associated with the borrowing. There's a chance the government may issue only a partial refund or may reject a business's claim altogether. Despite CBP's estimations, some supply chain experts believe it may take years for the Trump administration to dole out the rebates as a result of the sheer magnitude of the money in question. If refunds take longer than anticipated, the interest accrued on a loan may be greater than the refund itself. As time goes on without definitive answers on refunds, Harrell sees more companies taking actions like selling the rights to their claims, preferring to pocket money now instead of waiting for a sum down the line. CFOs are going to prefer to have clarity and certainty around their capital, he said, as opposed to uncertainty on a contingent government receivable with no defined timeline. We've done several articles on Anthropic lately and its problem with its governments with the Pentagon. Now we're going to do another Anthropic article, but it's on a little different topic. The article is by Beatrice Nolan. It's from Fortune magazine, dated April 14th. The title is Anthropic Faces User Backlash Over Repeated Performance Issues with Its Claude AI Chatbot. Anthropic's popular Claude AI model has seen a significant decline in performance recently, according to many developers and heavy users, who say the model increasingly fails to follow instructions, opts for sometimes inappropriate shortcuts, and makes more mistakes on complex workflows. The complaints appear to be connected to recent changes Anthropic quietly made to the way Claude operates, reducing the model's default effort level in order to economize on the number of tokens or units of data the model processes in response to each request. The more tokens processed per task, the more computing power that task consumes, and there is widespread speculation that Anthropic, which has announced fewer multi-billion dollar deals for data center capacity than some of its rivals, may be running short of computing resources after adoption of its products soared in the past few months. User dissatisfaction with Claude's sudden performance decline and anger at Anthropic's perceived lack of transparency could potentially derail the company's runaway growth, just as it is hoping to woo investors for a potential IPO. The claims that Anthropic has not been candid about the changes it's made to the way Claude operates, or the way the changes may increase the cost for using Claude, are particularly threatening to Anthropic, because it, more than any other AI company, has tried to build a brand reputation on being more transparent than other AI companies and more aligned with its users' interests. Anthropic declined to answer Fortune's specific questions about Claude's users' complaints on the record. Boris Cherney, the Anthropic executive who leads its Claude Code product, responded to user complaints online by saying that Anthropic had reduced the default effort Claude makes in answering user prompts to Medium in response to user feedback that Claude was previously consuming too many tokens per task. But many users complained that the company has not highlighted this change to users. The situation has caused a pile-on of speculation and allegations, including from some of its competitors, that the company is purposefully degrading performance owing to a lack of compute capability. Across the industry, AI companies are facing rising GPU costs, constrained data center expansion, and difficult trade-offs over which products to prioritize as demand for agentic AI systems accelerates faster than infrastructure can scale. While an Anthropic spokesperson has said publicly that the AI lab does not degrade its models to better serve demand, there are reasons to believe the company is facing more acute constraints than some rivals. Anthropic suffered a series of recent outages as usage has increased and has introduced stricter usage limits during peak hours, drawing complaints from some users. In an internal memo reported by CNBC, OpenAI's revenue chief also claimed that Anthropic had made a strategic misstep by not securing enough compute capacity and was operating on a meaningfully smaller curve than competitors. Anthropic declined to answer CNBC's questions about these claims. Meanwhile, Anthropic also announced last week that it had trained a new yet-to-be-released model called Mythos that is significantly more capable than its Opus AI model, but which is also larger and more expensive to run, meaning that it likely consumes more computing capacity than prior models. Anthropic stressed that it's not releasing the model to the general public yet because of security concerns, but some have questioned whether Anthropic lacks sufficient compute capacity to support a broad Mythos rollout. The scrutiny of Anthropic underscores the fast-changing nature of the AI market and the stakes involved. Just last week, Anthropic stunned the industry by announcing that its annualized recurring revenue, or ARR, is now $30 billion, up from $9 billion at the end of 2025. OpenAI said last month that it's generating $2 billion a month in revenue, or $24 billion a year, although the two companies do not report revenues in exactly the same way, making direct comparisons problematic. Anthropic has recently benefited from a flood of new users, first owing to the popularity of its AI coding tool, Claude Code, and later from a wave of consumer support that followed its feud with the U.S. Department of Defense. Many users switched to Claude from rivals such as OpenAI's ChatGPT after the Trump administration designated Anthropic a supply chain risk. Anthropic had said the dispute stemmed from its insistence that the U.S. government agree in its contract not to use the company's technology in lethal autonomous weapons or for the mass surveillance of American citizens. Over the last few years, Anthropic has gained significant ground in the AI race, emerging as a leader in enterprise AI and building up significant goodwill among developers and enterprise users. But if the anger around Claude's performance issues persists, it risks eroding some of that goodwill and could lead the company to stumble at a critical moment. In response to some of the controversy surrounding Claude's recent performance issues, Czerny, the Claude Code head, said that Claude Opus 4.6, Anthropic's flagship model, had introduced adaptive thinking in early February, which allows the model to decide how much reasoning to apply to a given task, rather than using a fixed budget. In early March, Anthropic also shifted the default code setting down to a medium effort level, Czerny said. While Claude Code users can manually change the tool's effort levels, users who pay for the pro versions of CoWork or the desktop version of Claude are not able to change the defaults at this time. To resolve some of the user issues, Czerny said, the company will test defaulting teams and enterprise users to high effort, to benefit from extended thinking, even if it comes at the cost of additional tokens and latency going forward. He also pushed back on speculation that the model has been purposely watered down and on complaints from users that the change was rolled out with a lack of transparency, claiming the changes were made in response to user feedback and were flagged to users via a pop-up within the Claude Code interface. Most of the user complaints center on Claude Code, Anthropic's AI-powered coding tool, which has become one of the company's most popular and fast-growing products. Launched in early 2025, Claude Code operates as a command-line agent that can read, write, and execute code autonomously within a developer's environment. Since its debut, it has been widely adopted by individual developers and large enterprise engineering teams who rely on it for complex, multi-step coding tasks. The recent change in the performance of Claude Code gained widespread attention on social media thanks to a GitHub analysis that appears to be from Stella Lorenzo, a senior director of AI at AMD. In a widely shared analysis, Lorenzo said the changes had made Claude unusable for complex engineering tasks. In her analysis, she found that from late February into early March, Claude moved from a research-first approach, reading multiple files and gathering context before making changes, to a more direct, edit-first style. The model reads less context before acting, makes more mistakes, and requires significantly more user intervention, according to the analysis. The analysis also points to a rise in behaviors like stopping too early, avoiding responsibility, or asking unnecessary permission, which it links to a reduction in thinking depth over the same period. Claude has regressed to the point where it cannot be trusted to perform complex engineering, she wrote. In a comment responding to the analysis, Anthropic's Czerny says the analysis is likely misreading at least part of the data, claiming that the model's reasoning hasn't been reduced, but that Anthropic had made a change so that the full reasoning trace of the model is no longer visible to the viewer. But Lorenzo is far from the only person having issues with the tool. I have incredibly frustrating sessions with Claude Code over the past 2 weeks, Dimitri Papadopoulos, a principal research manager at Microsoft, wrote on X. I reset effort to max, yet it's extremely sloppy, ignores instructions, and repeats mistakes. Now we're going to change the topic completely. I don't think many of us listening here are involved in child raising anymore. However, if you have a relative that is, here are some numbers on what it costs. The article is by Jacqueline Muniz. It's from Fortune magazine, dated April 13th. almost unmanageable. Raising a child in the U.S. now costs more than $300,000. The experience of being a parent may be priceless, but the reality is there's a price tag on raising a child, and it's up in the hundreds of thousands. The average cost of raising a child over the course of 18 years in the United States has reached $303,418, according to a new study from LendingTree. The total cost varies widely by state. Hawaii is the most expensive state to raise a child, with LendingTree projecting a price tag of $412,661. Alaska and Maryland follow behind, with $365,000 and $362,000, respectively. Meanwhile, New Hampshire is the cheapest state to raise a child, costing $201,963, less than half the price of Hawaii. Washington, D.C., which offers free preschool for 3 and 4-year-olds, and South Carolina, come in second and third place for the least expensive places to raise a child. The cost of raising a child is up 1.9% from a year ago due to significant increases to rent and clothing costs. LendingTree found that the average rent has spiked from $1,128 from their last survey in 2025 to $1,680 this year, nearly a 50% increase. Clothing costs were up by more than 25% from a year ago. Inflation is just taking a toll, clearly, on people, and it's certainly one of the reasons why we saw such significant growth here, Matt Schultz, chief consumer finance analyst at LendingTree, who authored the study, told Fortune. In some states, the costs associated with raising a child are increasing much faster than the rate of inflation. The study found that Kansas and Alaska's projected 18-year child-rearing costs jumped 23.5% between LendingTree's 25 and 26 analysis, and Montana increased by 21.7%. Childcare costs are by far the highest expense for families with children under 5. According to LendingTree's analysis, parents in Hawaii pay an average of $40,342 per year, whereas families in Maryland and Massachusetts pay $36,419 and $34,247, respectively. 14 states saw the cost of raising a small child increase by at least 10%. Sparsely populated states such as Nebraska, Montana, and Wisconsin all saw early child-rearing cost jump by at least 23% due to the lack of options and high demand. A few states and even areas within various states are what are called child care deserts, where there's just not nearly enough supply of daycare and child care centers to keep up with the demand for it, Schultz explained. So what happens is that the ones that are there, and especially the really good ones that are there, can charge basically whatever they want to charge, and it ends up driving up the rates quite a bit. Child care is affordable if it consumes no more than 7% of a household income, according to federal guidelines. With child care averaging $28,190 a year, a household would have to earn $402,708 for it to be considered affordable. But the average two-child household has an average income of $145,656, just over one-third of that target. A February survey from the National Association for the Education of Young Children found 65% of child care centers and 51% of public school-based programs reported tuition increases. Nearly a third of home-based child care providers raise tuition. It's a real challenge for people who really need the help, Schultz said. As much as we wish that people had a relative or a trusted friend that they could lean on for that sort of thing, a lot of people just don't have that choice, so they have no other choice but to pay whatever they need for daycare. High child care costs are detrimental to long-term savings, like building an emergency fund or putting money away for college or retirement, Schultz said. It just turns a really challenging situation into an almost unmanageable one for people. And that's why we see so many people factoring in finances when it comes to time to decide whether to start a family or how many kids they might have. For some families, it's a choice between a parent working or paying for child care. As much as we wish that we didn't have to think about the cost of being a parent, you're doing yourself and the family a bit of a disservice if you don't, because there are very, very few among us who, for whom the cost of raising a child is not significant, Schultz said. We're going to do a series of short articles now on a variety of topics. This is from the Fortune Daily newsletter. Here's the first item. In a landmark decision, a jury found Live Nation and Ticketmaster operated as a monopoly, leading the firm's shares to tumble 6%. You may not know this, but Live Nation owns Ticketmaster, and this particular lawsuit has been in progress for several years now. It has finally been resolved. Live Nation has been declared a monopoly. It remains to be seen exactly what the remedy on this is going to be. Gas prices are climbing past $4 per gallon in many parts of the country, and a top Democrat on the House Budget Committee is proposing a way to ease the pain at the pump: cut the federal gas tax. The levy currently sits at 18.4 cents per gallon, a rate unchanged since 1993, but it's unclear whether Republicans will back the proposed Gas Price Relief Act. For those of you golf fans listening in, Saudi Arabia is considering funding for the LIV Golf League, its PGA Tour rival that drew big stars with millions in advance payments, according to the Financial Times. The report has added to the speculation that the league could soon shut down, as it has never been profitable, despite being a centerpiece for Saudi Arabia's considerable investment in sports and entertainment in recent years. The amount of oil needed to produce the same amount of GDP today compared to the 1970s. That number is one-third as much. The world today uses oil more efficiently and productively, and we need less of it to do everything we need to do, according to Bank of America analyst Antonio Gabriel. That's why inflation is milder this time, and why GDP growth is less affected by the war. While a 10% oil price shock had an inflationary impact of 90 basis points in 1970s, that impact appears to be about 25 basis points today, he told clients in a recent note, and the cost in terms of lower growth has diminished from over 70 basis points in the earlier period to about 5 basis points today. And for you crypto fans in the audience, this is again from Fortune magazine. This article is by Ben Weiss. The title of the article is Bitcoin and Ethereum Approach 2 Months Highs as Markets Grow Optimistic Over U.S.-Iran Peace Negotiations. Crypto markets are betting that the U.S. and Iran war may be progressing towards peace. Bitcoin rose 5% over the past 24 hours to around $75,000 early Tuesday afternoon, nearing its highest mark since February, according to data from Binance. The world's second largest cryptocurrency, Ethereum, notched an even bigger day-over-day jump, rising 7% to almost $2,400 to record a 2-month high. The total market capitalization of all cryptocurrencies rose 4% to $2.6 trillion, mirroring gains in the stock market. On Tuesday morning, the S&P 500 increased 1% and the NASDAQ jumped nearly 2%. The rise in cryptocurrencies was driven by an impressive recovery in risk appetite in traditional financial markets, said Alex Kupcevich, chief market analyst at the online brokerage FX Pro, in a note. Bitcoin's rise above $75,000 is a dose of optimism for traders who've watched the world's largest cryptocurrency struggle to record a sustained rally amid a volatile 6 months. In October, Bitcoin recorded an all-time high of around $126,000, but then plummeted after Trump issued a new set of tariff threats against China. The broader digital assets market failed to recover, and prices continued to drop through the end of January until Bitcoin began to hover around $60,000 to $75,000 throughout February and March. The cryptocurrency's price fluctuations have since largely tracked the broader ups and downs of the financial markets, which have been whipsawed by conflict in the Middle East and worries over rising oil prices. Chad Janis, founder of nutritional gummies brand Grunes, secured one of the consumer packaged goods' best and fastest exits of the past decade, as Unilever announced last week it would acquire the brand for an estimated $1.2 billion. Beaverton, Oregon-based Grunes currently has around 1 million customers, and its superfood gummy bear is the top-selling green supplement on Amazon and across retailers nationwide. For those of you that are big YouTube fans, YouTube plans to increase the prices of its premium plans for U.S. subscribers, its first hike since 2023. The company also denied claims it added unskippable 90-second ads for users watching on their TVs. $2 is the amount of the price increase. How much the cost of an individual YouTube premium plan will increase by, for a total of $15.99 per month. The company said of the price jump, it's to continue delivering a high-quality experience that supports creators and artists on YouTube. And finally, the share of TV viewing in the U.S. that YouTube captured in January, it's the most of any streaming service, and the number is 12.5%. Here's another short article on the implications of the Iran war for the U.S. economy. A clearer picture of the Iran war's economic impact is beginning to emerge as inflation accelerated dramatically in March. Consumer prices climbed by 0.9% between February and March, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported, driven by a 10.9% hike in energy prices, the largest single-month gain the category has seen since 2005. Meanwhile, consumer sentiment fell to an all-time low in April, according to the University of Michigan's widely tracked survey, as respondents expressed concern about the conflict disrupting prices. Even if the war ends and the Strait of Hormuz reopens, it would take several months for oil, gasoline, diesel, and other commodity supplies to snap back to pre-war levels, wrote Katie Boskowich, Nationwide's chief economist. Now for a quick one on Canada. The Canadian travel boycott of the United States shows no signs of letting up, with visitation from the country down 35% since President Donald Trump returned to office, data released Monday from Statistics Canada show. The boycott has also dealt a massive blow to the U.S. economy. The decline in Canadians taking road trips into the U.S. compared to March 2024. Total number is down 35%. The increase in Canadian visitation overseas year to year, a sign Canadians are swapping the U.S. for other international destinations. Overseas visitation is up 5%. And finally, the number of consecutive months that more Canadians flew to overseas destinations than drove to the U.S. That is 3 months in a row. Here's a longer article, also from Fortune magazine, this time by Nick Lichtenberg, dated April 15th. Title of the article is, "The Starter Economy is Broken." For generations, the arc of early American adulthood followed a predictable script. Land a first job, buy a used car, rent an apartment, eventually own a home. The starter economy, that cluster of accessible entry-level goods and opportunities that allowed young Americans to build towards something, was the foundation of the American dream's credibility. For Generation Z, that foundation has cracked. A recent Gallup survey found just 59.2% of U.S. adults anticipate a high-quality life 5 years from now, the lowest level since measurement began nearly two decades ago. Since 2020, that figure has fallen 9.1 percentage points, the equivalent of an estimated 24.5 million fewer Americans expressing optimism about the future. The causes aren't hard to find. Starter home prices have risen 87% over the past 7 years, according to Realtor.com. The average new car now costs roughly $49,000, a 27% increase from 2020. And hiring of workers aged 25 or younger has dropped more than 45% compared with 2019. The starter economy, in short, has been priced out of reach. Structural forces compressing Generation Z's economic entry point have been building for years, but converged with unusual force in the post-pandemic era. The housing deficit alone now stands at 4 million units, with Realtor.com calculating nearly 1.82 million Gen Z and millennial households that historically would have formed simply haven't formed. Instead, they're trapped by scarce supply and elevated borrowing costs. In a recent analysis of 40 years of labor market data, Goldman Sachs economists found that workers displaced early in their careers, from age 25 to 35, are largely delayed in entering the housing market and thus build less wealth over time. In 2025, the median age of a first-time homebuyer hit an all-time high of 40. Even under the most optimistic construction scenarios, closing the supply gap would take roughly 7 years, according to Realtor.com. Auto markets have followed similar pattern. Per Kelley Blue Book, the average new vehicle transaction price reached a record $50,318 in December 2025, before settling at $49,191 in January, still 2% higher than a year ago and nearly double what entry-level buyers could have expected a generation ago. Used cars, historically the safety valve for young buyers, now average more than $25,000. The job market tells the most complicated story. On the surface, overall unemployment stands at 4.4%, but the unemployment rate for workers aged 16 to 24 reached 10.8% last year, more than twice the national figure. Revello Labs offered a striking finding. The average new hire age rose to 42 in 2025 as employers prioritized experience. AI adoption is increasingly cited as a compounding factor, as companies eliminate the junior roles that once served as on-ramps into skilled professions. Psychological toll is registering in hard data. As of year-end 2025, Gallup found just 48% of Americans qualified as thriving, down sharply from 59.2% at the June 2021 peak. Only five Gallup readings have ever come in lower, all of which were recorded during the Great Recession or at the onset of the pandemic. The pessimism is real, but the data tells a more complicated story. Despite record prices and elevated mortgage rates, Generation G's homeowner rate is actually tracking ahead of millennials at the same age. According to Redfin, roughly 30% of Gen Z adults owned a home as of early 2026, a higher share than millennials had achieved by the same point in their lives, when the scars of the 2008 financial crisis had frozen them out of the market entirely. The generation isn't buying less, it's buying differently, smaller homes in lower-cost metros, often with parental co-investment. The jobs picture is also more nuanced than the entry-level collapse suggests. While AI is eliminating some junior roles, It is also creating new categories of work that skew young: digital content, AI prompt engineering, and tech-adjacent services, many of which didn't exist a decade ago and carry no formal credential requirements. On wealth accumulation, the incoming great wealth transfer complicates the pessimism narrative significantly. An estimated $84 trillion in assets is expected to pass from baby boomers to younger generations over the next two decades, with Generation Z standing to inherit more than any prior cohort at a comparable stage of life. And a word about those millennials. They recovered from those scars fairly well. The Wall Street Journal recently compared the economic fates of millennials and baby boomers side by side and let readers make up their own mind. Millennials are, by and large, pretty wealthy now, but each generation had its cross to bear. Mortgage rates of 18% for baby boomers versus nearly $30,000 in student debt for millennials. As Joshua Brown, CEO of Ritholtz Wealth Management, posted on LinkedIn, the reason it doesn't feel like the millennials have leveled up is that the boomers are still very much around, accumulating even bigger gains in stocks and the values of the businesses they own. Their spending is keeping prices high throughout the economy. Millennials did not get to take over the way that boomers did as the silent generation faded out. Millennials may be on deck, waiting to get an at-bat and take a swing. But Generation Z couldn't be faulted for feeling like they can't get off the bench right now. And here's our last short article of the day. The surging inflation making its way through the economy may not always be obvious. Businesses like restaurants, hotels, and airlines are passing along higher prices as separate line items. Common examples include credit card surcharges and service fees at restaurants or increased baggage fees, which multiple airlines have enacted this month to offset rising jet fuel prices. But don't expect costs to come down again, even if the temporary justification is resolved. Lower fuel costs would certainly help us boost our margins this year and clearly into next year as well, Delta Airlines CEO Ed Bastian said recently. And folks, that's it for today. Thank you so much for listening. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. See you next Monday at 11.